Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The 1985 Heysel Stadium disaster is a far-off, almost forgotten tragedy. But for those directly affected, it casts long shadows. Brussels in the 1980s was a bourgeois, cosmopolitan city, mesmerizing in its linguistic complexities, but relaxed, at ease with itself. The Irish community was small. We had a Gaelic club, which played occasional matches, and a soccer team in the Brussels Embassy League. Through this rather loose connection, 10 of us got tickets for that year's European Cup final at Heysel Stadium on the 29th of May. Unexpected, but very exciting. Liverpool were facing Juventus, and our tickets were for the neutral terrace. The day itself was hot, steamy and sticky. Ahead of the game, fans gathered and drank strong Belgian beer in the many bars around the Grand Place. We went directly from work by metro from Schumann, the European Commission headquarters. Our suits left at the office, T-shirts and jeans more in keeping with our anticipation of a great game between Europe's leading clubs. Getting into the ground presented few difficulties. Local policemen surveyed the good-humoured crowd. Around us on the neutral terrace were many Belgian-born Italians, most of them sons of migrant workers who had come to work in the mines after the war. The first hints of trouble were fairly mild. Some Liverpool fans started chanting from their terrace, divided from us neutrals by only some flimsy barriers and a handful of policemen. But chanting is normal enough. Attention now turned to the match just 20 minutes from kickoff. Then some Liverpool fans started tossing things at us. Oranges, apples, tomatoes. The people around us became restless, like a herd sensing predators. What happened next was much more sinister. Harder missiles were coming our way. Some Liverpool supporters, thugs, not supporters in truth, were now hurling bottles at us and stones. They were swarming the little barriers. Now they were over them, brushing the hapless policemen aside and charging us, brandishing poles which moments earlier had carried proud Liverpool colours. We were in the midst of a panicking crowd, and quickly in the crush I was separated from my companions. Some of the crowd were running back up the terrace towards the exits, some pushing down towards the pitch. I decided going down wasn't good, and going up wasn't great either, so I tried to hold my ground. Those running back were wisest, I later discovered, for they escaped the imminent mayhem, but for the odd slap of a stick or loss of a shoe. Those pushing or being pushed downwards squeezed into others further down who fell and were crushed against the crumbling wall protecting the pitch. Such was the pressure, there was little chance to climb the wall and reach the pitch. Even if your arms were free, the rest of you was trapped in the crowd. I tried to hold on, but the crowd eventually forced me down. I fell, and those beside me did likewise, until we were a human heap, like a landslide, slowly rolling down the terrace. I managed to wriggle to a crowd barrier, which afforded some slight protection, and lay there trying to free my shoulders and breathe while being pinned down by falling and fallen bodies. I remember thinking, this is absurd. I've played hurling all my life. I've been in every big stadium watching GAA and rugby. And now I'm going to die at a football match because of hooliganism. But in 6 or 7 minutes, perhaps, I began to feel the pressure on my back ease and I could sense the crowd beginning to stand up behind me. The thugs seemed to be in retreat. I unsteadily began to stand up, but the two men who had been pressing down on my arms did not. They were motionless, either worn out by their efforts to stay alive or possibly already dead. Shaking, I looked around for help. I could see police reinforcements coming across the terrace. At the terrace walls, there were piles of people still unable to move, trapped just inches from the pitch and safety. Further up the terrace, bodies lay strewn where they fell. A Red Cross volunteer appeared beside me. Her colleagues would look after the injured, he told me. She helped me to the pitch and I walked unsteadily to the far end, trousers and shirt ripped, face, arms and hands scratched and bloodied to rest a while in safety. The pitch was slowly cleared of human casualties and incredibly, the match went ahead. This was afterwards explained as being to reduce the risk of more crowd trouble. I stood in a daze for a while, then managed to get out, onto a metro and back to Schumann to join my girlfriend and other friends and seek out news of those who had not yet returned from Heysel. It was a long night of waiting and wondering until 2 or 3 in the morning when we were able to confirm that all our friends were safe. I was also trying to phone home, fully aware that the tragedy had been shown live on television, unfolding as the TV audience waited for the match to begin. When I finally got through to my parents, it was 11:30, as the lines had been blocked for hours. I could hear the relief and uncharacteristic emotion in my father's voice when he said, "We're so delighted you're all right." Next day, we woke up to a shocking toll of death and destruction. Among the 39 dead, all from the neutral terrace, were 32 Italians, 4 French, 2 Belgians, and a man from Belfast. About 600 people had been injured and treated by the emergency services or in hospitals across Belgium. There was much debate as to responsibility. Certainly the stadium was run down and unsuitable by the standards of the time. The placing of Liverpool fans was thoughtless, not least given the growing reputation of a small cohort of English fans for causing trouble and their lack of distinction between neutrals and opposing fans. Security was far from perfect, and policing within the stadium was almost totally lacking. In fact, it seems preparations by all concerned were hopelessly inadequate, with the important exception of the medical services. But not one of these inadequacies justifies the appalling behaviour of the perpetrators who had love of violence as their motive and certainly not love of football. The wheels of justice turned slowly. Almost 5 years later, some thugs were convicted of manslaughter and received very short sentences for the part they played in the disaster. As far as I was concerned, the message that violent hooliganism is not subject to proportionate justice could not have been clearer. I've never forgotten that day. 35 years on, I still think about those young men on the terrace around me who never came home. Husbands, brothers, sons. Children unborn, dreams unfulfilled. All because of a tragedy that should never have happened.
She has always been there. Her poems have this knack of finding me just when I need them the most. The first Evan Bolan poem I ever read was The Emigrant Irish. I was 19, at university in Boston, and bewildered by homesickness for Dublin. And here was this poem. Patience, fortitude, long suffering. In the bruised, coloured dusk of the new world, and all the old songs, and nothing to lose. I read those lines again and again. They were a salve. Yes, I was homesick, but I too had all the old songs, and while I might have had nothing to lose, I had everything to gain. That was the year I had my first poem published in a university journal. Evan Boland made poems that made people feel braver. Years later, while living in Japan, the poet Paula Meehan sent me a copy of Boland's collection, The Lost Land. Evan had kindly written an inscription on the inside cover. It read, "To Rachel, with best wishes from home. Love, Evan." I read the title poem, The Lost Land. I have two daughters. They were all I ever wanted from this earth, or almost all. I also wanted one piece of ground, one city trapped by hills, one urban river, an island in its element. Sure, I read that and hatched plans. I came home to Dublin, sat in workshops with Evan Boland and Paula Meehan, and signed up for the long apprenticeship as a poet. I didn't get the two daughters, but I got two lovely sons, a darling husband, and a Dublin home with a back garden. My piece of ground. Evan Boland made poems that made people seek out a home on their own terms. Even as a young mother, especially as a young mother, the poems of Evan Boland were a great comfort. I'd be wall-fallen from breastfeeding a newborn and a one-year-old, sculling back strong black coffee and rereading Evan's night feed like me life, or at least me sanity, depended on it. This is the best I can be, housewife, to this nursery, where you hold on, dear life. However, it was not until I sat in a pediatric ICU watching the rise and fall of the breath of my very ill child did a line from Boland's journey poem come back to me. There has never been a poem to an antibiotic. You can sing it, sister. Evan Boland made poems that made sense of mothers and mothering. For the last 20 years, I have taught a module on Evan Boland and Paula Meehan. Some of my students call it the Northside and Southside Dublin Women Kick-Ass Class. Be that as it may, every time I teach these poets, my students lap up the poems. Last term, when we read Boland's Blossom poem, I looked down and one of my mature students was in tears. At the end of the class, I asked my student, was she okay? And she said, oh yeah, it's just the poem, that line. How much longer will I see girlhood in my daughter? It makes me want to go home and hug the 14-year-old I wanted to murder this morning. Evan Boland made poems that made sense out of people's everyday lives. And now, at this historical moment called COVID-19, I turn to Boland's quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people. Sure, what else would you be reading? I mean, I think this poem should go out with the Angelas every evening. Evan Boland made poems that made sense of how some people may be forever lost to historical moments. She has always been there. Her poems have this knack of finding me just when I needed them most. When word came in last month of Evan Boland's sudden death, I stood in front of me bookshelf and ran me fingers along the spines of her books. I closed me eyes and thought of her beloved husband, devoted daughters, and enchanting grandchildren. Then I asked the goddess of chance poems to help me find some solace. I opened a collection on a random page and a poem was there. This moment, a neighbourhood at dusk. Things are getting ready to happen. Out of sight, stars and moths and rinds slanting around fruits. But not yet. One tree is black. One window is yellow as butter. A woman leans down to catch a child who has run into her arms. This moment. She has always been there. Her poems are still here. Evan Boland made poems. Beautiful poems.
Charlotte and I found him on Darcy Avenue in Toronto. That's why we called him Darcy. When I spotted him, he was huddled and quaking under a car, a tiny white fur ball with a black Gorbachev smudge on his forehead and a plump black tail finished off with a shock of white. We dutifully did the rounds of the houses on the street, asking if this kitten belonged here. People shook their heads and apologetically smiled no, in a way that indicated we were going to be stuck with him. I didn't realize then that he would become one of the most significant parts of my life, in spite of the fact that, to put it mildly, he never really liked me. We thought he was only a few weeks old. He was so small. It turned out he was almost 5 months. He must have lost his mother quite early. As a result, he had little in the way of feline skills. He was scared of birds. He was scared of squirrels. The sight of wildlife in the garden induced a panicked hiss and a full-on, all-paws, 3-foot-high, cartoonish leap into the air. Snow, and bear in mind this is Canada, where snow covers the ground 5 months of the year, bewildered him, and he would grumble and growl his way through it, lost in its whiteness, save for the black, periscopic tail. He never learned how to retract his claws, and getting stuck in the furniture provoked panic in him. The vet suggested we put him on a drug to calm him down, in the hope that he'd eventually figure out how to get unstuck. This is how, to my knowledge, he was the only kitten in the world with a prescription for Prozac. It didn't really work, but he did learn to live with his disability. Many's the time we'd come home to discover him stuck to the side of the couch and asleep, having given up the struggle to be free. On that day we first found him, on the drive home, he lay in my lap in the passenger seat curled up in an old T-shirt. That, it turned out, was the closest he and I would ever get. Shortly after, I came back to Ireland for an extended visit to see family and friends, and upon my return to Canada, there had been a definite change in the house. Darcy was a one-person cat, and that one person was Charlotte. I was a usurper, my presence resented on the couch and in bed. It's a lovely thing, we think, to have a cat curl up next to a person, but when that curling up involves the cat actively pushing the other human on the couch away, it's somewhat less endearing. It's quite a thing to watch a gap growing between you and your spouse getting ever bigger and ever furrier. It wasn't just that he preferred her to me. He actually seemed to hate me. He had a contemptuous facial expression reserved just for my benefit. He would push books off the nightstand, mine, of course, never Charlotte's, and mugs of coffee off the kitchen table, mine, of course, never Charlotte's. Once he peed in the laundry basket, somehow targeting only my clothes. He used to claw and bite as I passed, and of course, only a fool would try to pick him up, resulting in a spray of arterial blood that wouldn't be out of place in a Sam Peckinpah Western. I had to hold my ground where I could. Darcy was a big cat, 13 pounds, with broad shoulders and a large backside. The polite term for his frame is Rubenesque. When he walked up and down stairs, there was a gentle undulation to his steps, his back end swinging like a pendulum. I called him Waddlebum. Years after, Darcy bulldozed his way into our lives, but nothing to do with him. Our marriage ended. Charlotte left the country, and the cat realized grimly that it was now just the two of us. He had to learn to tolerate me the way you do an annoying but necessary flatmate. we would have to actually get on. It took him some time to adjust to the new way of things. His meow, previously an aloof whine of general contempt at my temerity in so much as looking at him, became a baffled, weary sigh, as if to say, "Oh, you're still here?" But now he deigned to spare my books, mugs, and laundry. The scratching, too, became less vicious, almost playful, and usually bloodless. He still slept on the bed, as far from me as possible, naturally, but eventually he started curling up next to me, and after a time he granted me permission to stroke him, resulting in the satisfactory rumbling engine noise called purring that all cat owners know and crave. Later, in the revolving door of our post-divorce friendship, I was the one who was going out, back to Dublin, while Charlotte returned, and the cat was noticeably happier with this new, old arrangement. A while ago, Charlotte called to say she had to put Darcy to sleep. He had become sick in his old age. He was 16, fair age for a cat. She said he was cuddly with her all the way to the end. Of course he was. I'd like to think that if I had been there, he'd have let us both hold him as he drifted off into an eternal slumber. I know, of course, that it would have been a disaster, that the vet would probably have had to perform emergency surgery on me. Still, I often think of, and in spite of everything, miss that fat, furry blob curled up by my side, paws gently but firmly pushing me away.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against a tree. She doesn't mind the language, it's the beating she don't need. She lets loose all the horses when the corporal is asleep. And he wakes to find the fire's dead and arrows in his axe. And Davy Crockett rides around and says it's cool for cats.
Sesame, in memory of Ivan Boland. After the reading, we were standing around, gently besting each other, the way poets do, our lips wine-stained, our glasses empty. And one amongst us told a story of how once, when his computer froze, he uttered in despair a litany of supplication, reciting one by one the name of every poet he could think of. And how, when he named you, the screen magically cleared, like the entrance to that cave the 40 thieves had filled with gold when Ali Baba shouts out, "Open Sesame!" And although you laughed as well, I hear you now reminding us how, in the Arab folktale, that sharp-eyed woodcutter is saved in the end by the quick-witted Morgiana, neither the first time nor the last that a man eager for treasure is saved by a clever woman. And how a word can be a seed that in the right place flowers and becomes a mouth opening into a kind of heaven.
There's a bend in the road, 1.9 kilometres from home. I've named it COVID Corner. When I get to that point on my evening rambles, I cross the road and head back the way I've come. These rambles have been blessed by good weather, and the field on one side is ablaze with the yellow flame of rapeseed. On the other, the long field is dotted with sheep and lambs, and a broken hedge of ancient thorn that runs down to the river. The remnant of another time, when fields were smaller and life was even harder than it is now. Whether it's the lambs or the sheep or the ancient ditch, I find my mind being drawn on these twilight meanderings to questions biblical. I've begun composing replies from the Romans and Thessalonians and Corinthians to Paul's letters and tirades. I imagine groups of men and women sitting around fires, discussing the correct wording of their responses. A man suggests telling Paul where to get off. The quieter voice of a woman urges caution. There's a suggestion that they deny ever receiving his missives and blame it on the unreliable postal system of the time. But last night, something in the air took me back even further, to the book of Ecclesiastes. And I began to wonder about the man or woman who composed that volume. And then I thought about the beautiful third chapter that begins, "To everything there is a season." And I found myself speculating on what the author might have made of the current situation. I imagined the writer confined at home, a 40-something-year-old with a spouse and two children, both in their teens. And just for the heck of it, I gave the family a pet terrapin. With that, I handed the puzzled writer a blank sheet of paper and a pen and allowed them the freedom of my sometimes bizarre imagination. And this was the outcome. "To everything there is a season and a time to every tortoise under heaven. A time to get up in the morning because it's good to stick to a routine. And a time to turn off Netflix at night. A time to plant the 7 packets of seeds you bought online. And a time to dig out the beetroot that has grown all winter and will never be cooked or eaten. A time to kill the neighbours 2 doors down who play heavy metal in the garden late into the evening. And a time to try to heal that rift with the neighbour who jumped the queue at the car wash when such things mattered. A time to break down the wall of the kids' bedroom and get them out into the air. And a time to build up some brownie points with the in-laws. A time to mourn the fact that there won't be a football kicked in anger all summer and Dublin will thus remain unbeaten. And a time to dance to the sound of the killer's human because it seems to catch the state of the race. A time to cast away stones that harbour slugs in the raised bed. And a time to gather stones together for flinging at the neighbours 2 doors down who are still playing that bloody heavy metal. A time to remember embracing because it has become a thing of the past. And a time to refrain from embracing long-lost friends in the supermarket car park because that's what the yellow leaflet says. A time to get online to order that book that you've been meaning to read since you were 18. And a time to lose all patience with the internet that keeps slipping offline because of the faulty cables at the end of the street. A time to keep quiet about the terrapin's cage not being cleaned. And a time to clear out the attic and cast away those football programmes which will never alter the full-time score in 98. A time to rend that T-shirt that used to be loose on you while doing the ad break jumping jacks during Operation Transformation. And a time to admit that you feel only so-so. A time to keep your mouth shut and stay silent. And a time to tell the kids what you really think of them and their terrapin. A time to love the world in all its natural beauty. And a time to admit that you're beginning to hate the neighbours 2 doors down with their heavy metal dump, dump, dump. A time to plan a campaign of war against them that involves cutting down an electricity pole. And a time of peace as you reach the 2K point on the road and stop to enjoy a silence that knows nothing of Metallica and Motorhead. To everything, there is indeed a season and brighter seasons will follow.
Wolf Song, in memory of Ivan Boland. Sit still now, take up your pen. In this space before noise begins, tigers are visiting the cities, and a white leopard sits on a lawn in suburbia. A wolf is walking along an empty beach in California. A poet sings his traces. Now she too is becoming history. Already, the first slow movement of the strings is parting the silence. This is the point in the story when shadows thin as blades take over the April sky. You can see the wolf through them. Soon, he too will be gone, forgotten. This long free walk by the sea, a detour. The sea will remember him. When he licked my hand at the hawthorn, his eyes sharpened the salt air.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Heysel Stadium Disaster by Michael Hamill. Ivan Boland Made Poems by Rachel Hegarty. Life with Furball was from Niall McArdle. Sesame, in memory of Ivan Boland, was a poem by John O'Donnell. To Everything There Is a Season by John McKenna. And Wolf Song at the End, in memory of Ivan Boland, by Mary O'Malley. The music this morning included Chopin's Prelude No. 4 in E minor, Opus 28, played by Grigory Sokolov. Aoife na Cormac played Ilan Amon. Cool for Cats was from Squeeze. The Sea and Sinbad Ship from Scheherazade by Rimsky-Korsakov was played by Nemanja Radulovic on violin and Stephanie Fontanarosso on piano with the Double Sons Ensemble. We also heard Turn, Turn, Turn by The Byrds. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the programme producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.